Chapter 2, The Bible as Literature. For me, the Bible means the English Bible. More specifically, it means the authorised version of 1611, so called on account of its having been newly translated out of the original tongues by command of King James I. For me, therefore, the Bible is primarily a literary work, or rather a collection of such works, and is as much a part of English literature as Dryden's Virgil, Pope's Homer, or Fitzgerald's Omar Khayyam. The fact that, for me, the Bible is a literary work means that, for me, it cannot be the Word of God. Quite apart from the circumstance that I am a Buddhist and do not believe in the existence of a personal God, the creator and ruler of the universe, the fact that the Bible is clearly the work of a number of writers living at widely separate periods, and that it contains as many factual errors, contradictions, and interpolations as any other body of ancient writings, makes it impossible for me to regard it as the work of an omniscient author who at different times has dictated it, as it were, to various human amanuenses. I have never read the Bible straight through, from the book of Genesis to the book of Revelation, as some pious Christians do every year. But in the course of my life, I have read most of it, and some parts I have read a number of times. When I was in my teens, my favourite books were the Book of Job and the Song of Solomon, especially the former, which I read over and over again. I had the good fortune to possess a separate edition of these works, which, besides printing the text as poetry, as the authorised version of 1611 had done, also contained Blake's illustrations, which I have always admired, no less than the Book of Job itself. According to modern scholarship, the work was probably composed at the beginning of the 5th century BCE. The first two chapters are in prose, as is the last chapter. In between are 50 chapters of very fine, if sometimes repetitive, poetry. The poem revolves around a fundamental problem. Why does the good man suffer? The ancient Jews believed that the good man did not suffer, only the wicked suffer. If a man fears God and eschews evil, God will bless him with long life, offspring, and material wealth. Job is a good man, perfect and upright, and God had blessed him with 7 sons and 3 daughters, and with 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 she-asses, and a very great household. But suppose God were to take all that away, would Job not curse God? The story begins in heaven. One day the sons of God come to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also comes. He has been visiting the earth, and the Lord asked him if he has observed Job, a perfect and upright man, who fears God and eschews evil. Satan replies that he has indeed observed him. But Job has good reason to fear God, he says, for has not God always protected him and all his possessions? If the Lord were to deprive him of his possessions, Job would curse him to his face. The Lord thereupon delivers all Job's possessions into the power of Satan, but not Job himself. On one and the same day, the Sabaeans fall upon his oxen and his asses and take them away. The fire of God falls from heaven and burns up his sheep. The Chaldeans carry away his camels, and a great wind comes from the desert and blows down the house in which his sons and daughters are feasting, killing them all. Yet despite his misfortunes, Job does not curse God. Naked came I out of my mother's womb, he says. Naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Satan therefore again presents himself before the Lord. This time the Lord delivers Job's body into his power, though not his life. Whereupon Satan smites Job with boils from the soles of his feet to the crown of his head. Taking a fragment of pottery with which to scrape himself, Job then sits down amongst ashes, where he is visited by his three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, who have heard of his misfortunes and have come to comfort him. For 7 days and seven nights they sit down with him on the ground, out of sympathy, not saying a word. At last Job speaks, cursing the day he was born, and the poem proper begins. Let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night in which it was said, there is a man-child conceived. Let that day be darkness, let not God regard it from above, neither let the light shine upon it. Let darkness and the shadow of death stain it. Let a cloud dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, let darkness seize upon it. Let it not be joined unto the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Lo, let that night be solitary. Let no joyful voice come from therein. Let them curse it that curse the day, who are ready to raise up their mourning. Let the stars of the twilight thereof be dark. Let it look for light, but have none. Neither let it see the dawning of the day, because it shut not up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hid sorrow from mine eyes. Why died I not from the womb? Why did I not give up the ghost when I came out of the belly? Why did the knees prevent me? Or why the breasts that I should suck? For now I should have lain still and been quiet. I should have slept. Then had I been at rest with kings and counsellors of the earth, which built desolate places for themselves, or with princes that had gold, who filled their houses with silver. Or, as a hidden untimely birth, I had not been. As infants which never saw light, there the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary be at rest. When Job has concluded his speech, of which I have quoted rather more than half, Eliphaz replies to him at even greater length. In the words of the translator's marginal note, he reproveth Job for want of religion. No one who is innocent ever perishes, he declares, as Job himself has formerly taught many. But now, when he is being afflicted himself, he complains and questions God's justice. Instead of complaining, he should reflect on the greatness of God and be glad that God is punishing him, for in the long run this will benefit him greatly. Job will have none of this. He has cause for complaint, he exclaims, after reproving his friend for his unkindness. He proceeds to give eloquent expression to his desire for death, a desire which, he says, is quite justified. Bildad then speaks. How much longer will he go on repeating the same thing, he impatiently asks Job. God deals with men according to their works, as history abundantly shows. He punishes the wicked, and Job's present plight is simply an example of his justice. Job acknowledges God's justice, but goes on to argue that although God can destroy both the perfect and the wicked, if he so wills, the fact that he has afflicted him does not mean that he is not innocent. He then expostulates with God, asking why he has afflicted him. God knows he is not wicked. Why then should he afflict him, the work of his hands? He has suffered enough, he tells God. All he now wants is a little ease before death. Zophar then joins in the discussion, reproving Job for insisting on his innocence and emphasizing that God's wisdom is unfathomable. To this, Job replies in a long speech occupying three chapters, in the course of which he acknowledges God's omnipotence, reproves his friends for their partiality, and affirms his confidence in God. "Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him," he says. Eliphaz now speaks for the second time, again reproving Job for insisting on his innocence and describing at length the unhappiness of the wicked. By this time, Job has lost patience with his friends. "Miserable comforters are ye all," he tells them. But the debate continues nevertheless for 16 more chapters, after which Job's three comforters fall silent, quote, "because he is righteous in his own eyes," unquote. Elihu, who so far has not been mentioned, now speaks. In brackets, his speech may be an interpolation, close brackets. He is a much younger man and has not spoken before out of respect for his elders. He is angry with Job because he justifies himself, and with Job's three friends because they have not been able to convince him. He himself succeeds no better, however. Though he speaks at length, he is able to add little to what the friends had already said, and Job does not bother to answer him. We are now 9/10 of our way through the work and have reached its climax, the Lord's Speech. The Lord's Speech covers four chapters and is interrupted only by Job's brief acknowledgement of his vileness. He does not tell Job why he has been afflicted. Instead, speaking out of the whirlwind, he overwhelms him with a declaration of his greatness and power, as manifested by the whole of creation, saying, "Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee, and answer thou me. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest? Or who hath stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof, when the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Or who shut up the sea with doors, when it brake forth as if it had issued out of the womb? When I made the cloud the garment thereof, and thick darkness a swaddling band for it, and brake up for it my decreed place, and set bars and doors, and said, Hitherto shalt thou come, but no further, and here shall thy proud waves be stayed." He goes on in this vein, at one point asking Job with heavy sarcasm if he knows where light and darkness dwell because he was born then, or because the number of his days is great. More rhetorical questions follow. "Hast thou entered into the springs of the sea, or hast thou walked in the search of the depth? Have the gates of death been opened unto thee? Or hast thou seen the doors of the shadow of death? Hast thou perceived the breadth of the earth? Declare if thou knowest it all. Where is the way light dwelleth? And as for darkness, where is the place thereof? That thou shouldst take it to the bound thereof, and that thou shouldst know the paths to the house thereof. Knowest thou it because thou wast then born? Or because the number of thy days is great? Hast thou entered into the treasures of the snow? Or hast thou seen the treasures of the hail, which I have reserved against the time of trouble, against the day of battle and war? In what way is the light parted, which scattereth the east wind upon the earth? Who hath divided a watercourse for the overflowing of waters, or a way for the lightning of thunder, to cause it to rain on the earth where no man is, on the wilderness wherein there is no man, to satisfy the desolate and waste ground, and to cause the bud of the tender herb to spring forth? Hath the rain a father? Or who hath begotten the drops of dew? out of whose womb came the ice and the hoary frost of heaven? Who hath gendered it? The waters are hid as with a stone, and the face of the deep is frozen. The Lord then directs Job's attention to the animal kingdom, asking him if he knows the ways of the hind, the wild asses, and the unicorn, and whether he is able to control them. Next, Job is asked about the horse, which the unknown author of the book of Job describes in a manner that shows he had a painter's eye for the beauties and splendours of the natural world. Hast thou given the horse strength? Hast thou clothed his neck with thunder? Canst thou make him afraid as a grasshopper? The glory of his nostrils is terrible. He poureth in the valley, and rejoiceth in his strength. He goeth on to meet the armed men. He mocketh at fear, and is not affrighted. Neither turneth he back from the sword. The quiver rattleth against him, the glittering spear and the shield. He swalloweth the ground with fierceness and rage. Neither believeth he that it is the sound of the trumpet. He saith among the trumpets, Ha, ha! He smelleth the battle afar off, the thunder of the captains, and the shouting. Finally, after demanding of Job if he will disannul his judgment, or if he is in any way like him, he directs his attention first to Behemoth and then to Leviathan. Behold now Behemoth, which I made with thee. He eateth grass as an ox. Lo now, his strength is in his loins, and his force is in the navel of his belly. He moveth his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his stones are wrapped together. His bones are as strong pieces of brass. His bones are like bars of iron. He is the chief of the ways of God. He that made him can make his sword to approach unto him. Surely the mountains bring him forth food, where all the beasts of the field play. He lieth under the shady trees, in the covert of the reed and the fens. The shady trees cover him with their shadow. The willows of the brook compass him about. Behold, he drinketh up a river, and hasteth not. He trusteth that he can draw up Jordan into his mouth. He taketh it with his eyes. His nose pierceth through snares. The description of Leviathan is much longer, and no less magnificent, and concludes, He maketh the sea like a pot of ointment. He maketh a path to shine after him. One would think the deep to be hoary. Upon earth there is not his like, who is made without fear. He beholdeth all high things. He is a king over all the children of pride. The Lord's speech having come to an end, Job submits himself to God. I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes seeth thee. Wherefore I abhor myself, and repent in dust and ashes. The story ends with the Lord telling Eliphaz, in the concluding prose chapter, that he is angry with him and his two friends for not having spoken rightly of God, as Job had done. They are to offer up 7 bullocks and 7 rams by way of penance, and Job is to pray for them. Job himself is accepted by the Lord, who gives him 3 new daughters and 7 new sons, and double the number of sheep, camels, and yoke of oxen that he had before. Moreover, Job lives 140 years and sees his sons' sons, even to 4 generations. The book of Job has been described as the masterpiece of Hebrew literature, a judgment from which it is difficult to dissent. It is not a theodicy. It does not attempt to justify God's ways to men. Indeed, it views any such attempt as presumptuous. Its God is not the God of love, but the God of power, a power as manifest in the physical universe, from the starry heavens to the creatures of the earth, including man. As such, he is well able to inflict suffering on man, but he cannot tell him why he does so. Though the book of Job does not say so, man's questions must be answered by man himself. The Song of Solomon is much shorter than the book of Job and is not nearly so great a work. But it contains some lovely poetry, the rhythms of which, in the authorized version, are much lighter than are those of the magnificent strophes of the book of Job. Though the work is ascribed to King Solomon, it has no connection with him, and in its present form belongs to a much later period. It consists of a series of love poems, or wedding songs, which in one modern translation are distributed quite plausibly among the bridegroom, the bride, and the chorus. I have always loved its celebration of the coming of spring, when the lover, or bridegroom, shows himself through the lattice and says, "Rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. For lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth, the time of the singing of birds is come, and the voice of the turtle is heard in our land. The fig tree putteth forth her green figs, and the vines with the tender grape give a good smell. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away." There is also a passage which itemizes the charms of the loved one in terms that modern taste is likely to find odd, even grotesque. Such descriptions are not unusual in Elizabethan and Jacobean poetry. "How beautiful are thy feet with shoes, O prince's daughter! The joints of thy thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a cunning workman. Thy navel is like a round goblet, which wanteth not liquor. Thy belly is like an heap of wheat, set about with lilies. Thy two breasts are like two young roes that are twins. Thy neck is as a tower of ivory. Thine eyes like the fish pools in Heshbon by the gate of Bathrabin. Thy nose is as the tower of Lebanon which looketh towards Damascus. Thine head upon thee is like Carmel, and the hair of thine head like purple. The king is held in the galleries. How fair and how pleasant art thou, O love, for delights! This thy stature is like to a palm tree, and thy breasts to clusters of grapes." A more solemn note is struck in a short passage near the end of the work, where the lover says, "Set me as a seal upon thine heart, as a seal upon thine arm. For love is strong as death, jealousy is cruel as the grave. The coals thereof are coals of fire, which hath a most vehement flame. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can the floods drown it." The Song of Solomon was accepted into the Jewish canon of scriptures only after its contents had been interpreted as an elaborate allegory of God's love for his chosen people, the Jews. When the books of the Old Testament became part of the Christian Bible, the Song of Songs continued to be treated as an allegory, this time as an allegory of Christ's love for the church and the church's love for Christ. Some of the Christian mystics, especially those of a more devotional type, continued this tradition of allegorical interpretation of the work, in whose erotic imagery they found a language for the expression of their devotional longings and spiritual experiences. St. Bernard once delivered a series of impassioned sermons on the work, while its imagery informs some of the most beautiful poetry of St. John of the Cross. The Book of Job and the Song of Solomon both belong to a group of works known as the Wisdom Writings, as do the Book of Psalms, the Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes, or the Preacher. They are called Wisdom Writings because Jewish tradition ascribes most of them to the proverbially wise King Solomon, and the wisdom of which they treat is of a worldly, prudential kind that does not exclude an element of theistic piety. The Psalms have never appealed to me, but I have dipped into Proverbs from time to time, and have come across such maxims as, "Whoso loveth instruction loveth knowledge, but he that hateth reproof is brutish," and, "A soft answer turneth away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger," both of which have their parallels in the much more ancient wisdom literature of Babylon and Egypt. I've also enjoyed, in the admonition to the sluggard, the delightful vignette of the busy ant. Quote, "Go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways, and be wise, which have no guide, overseer, or ruler, provideth her meat in the summer, and gathereth her food in the harvest. How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep? Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, so shall thy poverty come as one that travaileth, and thy want as an armed man." I have also appreciated the realistic description from the unknown author's personal observation of what the marginal note bluntly calls the cunning of a whore. Quote, "For at the window of my house I looked through my casement, and beheld among the simple ones, I discerned among the youths, a young man void of understanding, passing through the street near her corner, and he went the way to her house, in the twilight in the evening, in a black and dark night. And behold, there met him a woman, with the attire of an harlot, and subtle of heart. She is loud and stubborn, her feet abideth not in her house, now she is without, now in the streets, and lieth in wait at every corner. So she caught him and kissed him, and with an impudent face said unto him, I have peace offerings with me, this day have I paid my vows, therefore I came forth to meet thee, diligently to seek thy face, and I have found thee. I have decked my bed with coverings of tapestry, with carved works, with fine linen of Egypt. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love until the morning. Let us solace ourselves with loves. For the good man is not at home. He is gone a long journey. He hath taken a bag of money with him, and will come home as the day appointed." With much fair speech she caused him to yield, with the flattering of her lips she forced him. He goeth after her straightway, as an ox goeth to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till a dart strike through his liver, as a bird hasteneth to the snare, and knoweth not that it is for his life. My least favourite books of the Bible are the so-called historical books of the Old Testament, such as the Book of Judges and 1 and 2 Samuel, which are not genuine histories but a mixture of history, folklore, legend and myth. They contain some good stories, some of which are as familiar to me from certain Renaissance paintings as they are from the pages of the Bible. But the historical books also contain much that I find abhorrent, so that I can well understand why Aldous Huxley should have referred to the Old Testament as, quote, "this savage Bronze Age literature."
For example, in 1 Samuel, the Lord commands King Saul through the prophet Samuel to destroy the Amalekites, saying, "Now go and smite Amalek, and utterly destroy all that they have, and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass." Since for Orthodox Christians the Bible, including the historical books, is the Word of God, passages like this one have enabled them to conduct crusades and pogroms with a clear conscience. For me, then, the Bible is literature, and it is as literature that I enjoy it. That it is not the Word of God does not mean that, for me, it is not inspired. Some parts of it, at least, are inspired in much the same way that some of my favourite poets are inspired. And in my book, that is no small praise.